Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. You're not Matt Kachansky, April Cameron. You're April Cameron, you're not Matt Kachansky.
Yep,
we got somebody filling in for Matt this week. So I've got, of course, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now one of the managers on our SIU team. And he has actually also undertaken a very interesting medical record retrieval project for one of our clients that he's been managing and taking a lot of his time. And so, Wade, good to see you as always. Matt is actually out at one of our clients doing an on-site for one of our SIU clients. As many of you know, we do a lot of on-site training in the SIU space. We mirror that training under OIG Best Practices. We take the 7 or 8 weeks that agents spend at the OIG Special Agent Basic Training, and we condense it down to however many days an SIU needs. And we actually have one client where we do a quarterly block, 4 hours of training, and Matt went out and did that one in person. So we've got April Cameron. April, I'm going to let you introduce yourself in a minute, but April is another retired OIG agent who has now been with us for about 6 months. She is our New York SIU director, and she interfaces with all of our New York SIU clients. And April and I know each other for about 25 or 26 years because she also worked with me at the New York office. And April retired recently and is now here at Advise helping us with our SIU. So April, give a quick introduction to everybody, and then we're going to jump into the topic of the day.
Good morning, Eric. Thank you. So as you said, I was with OI in New York for 25 years. I started right out of college. It was my first career. I retired from there, you know, having been a senior agent and many years of experience, having worked with you and all sorts of different cases. And I'm new to Advise as the New York director and happy to be part of this team.
Awesome. And we're going to talk about your career at OIG because it's going to parlay into this whole discussion. And today's topic really is going to be about getting into the FWA space. It's going to be transitioning into different FWA space roles, SIU roles. You know, we field a lot of questions during our training. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I get a lot of requests from people on LinkedIn to talk about getting into the fraud, waste, abuse space of people that work in the health, in this industry generally, but not necessarily in the investigative space. And sometimes, you know, people will ask what it's like to get into the OIG, how do you get in, transitions and things of that sort. But Wade, I want to start with you because, you know, I know you and I talk about this a lot. We've done a lot of hiring. When I was at OIG, I spent a lot of time on the interview panels. You as an ASAC were part of that initial vetting process and probably part of the ultimate decision-making about whether or not someone was going to be a fit for a job. So let's just start from the general perspective of you're looking at resumes and you're looking to do interviews of someone who is maybe a recent college grad or you know, new to the workforce. What are some of the things that you would be looking for in a resume from someone who may not have, you know, 20 years of experience in the SIU industry?
Well, one of the things, and we've talked about this quite a few times on past podcasts, is internships, I think, are a definite in the plus category. I mean, it kind of demonstrates kind of a general interest for, you know, maybe healthcare fraud if they happen to be with the OIG or a Mufuku, or at least investigative interest. I think that's one of the areas when we're conducting interviews is we want someone who's not applying just because it happens to be a vacancy that they've seen and they're putting in for, you know, 50 different agencies, other you know, three-letter agencies. So having something that sets them apart from the vast list of applicants that we get. Typically with the OI, we would have for each agent vacancy, we would have sometimes well more than 100 applicants. So it's, you kind of have to cut down, you know, you're not going to interview 100, you might decide you're going to interview 15 or 20. So they have to make that first cut, and having something like an internship or something that demonstrates a general interest for this type of job It doesn't have to be a criminal justice degree. We hired people with all different types of degrees, but I think they do need to show some kind of interest in the job, if not in the job in healthcare, but at least in an investigative position, because that's going to kind of turn into job retention. If they're just taking this because they need a job out of college and they're going to be continuing to look for something that they're more interested in, we're going to train them for eight months, 10 months, and then they might leave. So we need something that's going to at least tend to appear that it's going to be a retention issue. Like they're going to want us to be here for a while.
Right.
I think that's probably important.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, when I was in the office in New Jersey, I was the internship coordinator, and we would get interns each semester from Rutgers University. And so I would go over there a couple of times a semester and lecture to the class about things. And I was always amazed because it was an internship class and they had to go once a week and different presenters would come in. And I was always amazed at how many of the students that were doing internships were doing what amounted to a functionally useless internship. I can't tell you how many of these kids were sitting working as the receptionist at a law firm. Like that's their internship, making photocopies or doing whatever. And so they had an internship that really wasn't all that valuable. The other thing I was amazed at was when a lot of these students were interested in getting, they were having a criminal justice degree or a sociology, liberal arts degree, and they were doing these internships and they wanted to do something in with a criminal justice degree, but they didn't want a badge and a gun. And, you know, I had an intern that was very interested in staying in the healthcare space, but had no interest in the law enforcement part. And, you know, had a discussion with her about working in the SIU space, and that's where she ended up. And it wound up being a great move for her because she wanted to, I guess, in theory, use her criminal justice degree, but wanted to do something that wasn't specifically to law enforcement. So April, let's talk a little bit about, so, you know, you got hired very soon after you graduated from college. Had you done some internships when you were an undergrad?
I did not, actually. No. So, you know, the agency itself came as kind of like a surprise, right? Like a family friend recommended that I reach out to the supervisor at the time. I had never heard of HHS OIG. And I think like when we're talking about internships, I didn't have that opportunity. I would have loved it, I think, because it would have given me the chance to kind of get my feet wet with the kind of work that we did do with OI. And I always tried to make sure that when we had interns, that they weren't doing my photocopying, they weren't doing my scanning, that they were learning about the cases, they were learning about the work so that they could actually, you know, make a decision about, is this something that they'd want to do? Like answering the phones at a law firm is not going to help them decide right. If they want to work at a law firm, right? Like looking at, bank records and documents and participating in search warrants and arrest ops, like that's going to make their decision about whether they wanted to actually be in that field or not. And I didn't have that opportunity.
Yeah, I think today's climate in the educational space is a lot different. Internships are almost a requirement now. Mm-hmm. Right, kids need to have something on their resume. And I think our generation of people that were working, it just the internship thing wasn't a thing, and right. So it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. I mean, I've had interns that came from Rutgers who, you know, by the time they got to us, they were on their third or fourth internship, which you don't really see, you know, you didn't really see it as the case back then. Whereas now it's much more prevalent. And even from the internship perspective, you're right. I don't need an intern to make photocopies and answer the phone. I can do that myself. Right. You want them to get real life experience. Otherwise, what's the point of the internship? So April, while we're on that topic, so you get hired and you were right out of college. You really didn't have any experience. And so a lot of that had to do, and we've talked about mentoring, but a lot of it is that, you know, you're developing skills that come about as a result of having a mentor, having training agents, having people. A lot of times it's sometimes just people willing to help you. It isn't even a formal mentoring. It's just having, you know, someone that you can go to. So what were some of the skills that, had you known more about the job before you got to the job. What are some of the skills that you think are kind of prerequisites, whether it be, forget whether you're with the Office of Investigations or you're an SIU, a lot of these are transferable, right? The big difference is with the OIG, we had badges and guns and could do things like subpoenas and search warrants, but the investigation is still the investigation. What are some of the things that you think are kind of requisite skills people should be considering having?
You know, looking back at what I came to the table with at OI, you know, I was right out of college, didn't have a lot of skills, but I would definitely say computer skills, reviewing data, just the ability to kind of bob and weave, right? So to learn what the investigation is about, to interviewing, I think is a huge skill, that just being able to talk to people. So whether it's your team, whether it's a witness, whether it's a prosecutor, just being able to have a conversation and kind of get where you need to be by talking to people. I think that's probably one of the biggest skills, I think. And now I'm noticing now, even being here, is we have a great team and the team communicates with each other. And if you don't have those skills, then it's going to be a lot harder to get where you need to be.
You know, it's interesting. I was actually having a conversation with somebody the other day. Their kid is in college and they're talking about internships and putting their resume together. And I said, well, you know, my kid's been doing some work where they're like in a customer service role. And I was like, you have to highlight that on a resume because it involves a lot of that. It's communication, it's interaction, it's conversation. I think one of the biggest problems that we see today is kids spend so much time not talking. And so sometimes communication is odd. I remember we were interviewing a young lady for a position as an agent, and she worked as an SIU investigator at a plan. And one of the questions that was posed was, what's one of your biggest challenges at work? And, you know, you can come up with 100 things. Her answer was complex math. And I thought that was kind of odd. I was like, why is that? I didn't quite understand. But there was a disconnect in the question to the answer, right? It was an odd thing. And so some of that is just bringing some of those skills, you know, that are back around. But what are some of the things, like looking back now that you've been here for about 6 months, what are some of the things that you wish, as an OIG agent, you wish you knew when it came to SIU operations?
I think for me, it's the challenge is the administrative part, right? Like, so we are used to, we send a subpoena and we get what we need. You know, like there's a different approach now, right? Like, we don't have all the tools that we did as an OIG agent. And so it's kind of like trying to figure out the new way to do it, right? Like, we need information. So how are we going to get that information without the tools that we had when we were at OI? Like, we don't have subpoenas, we don't have search warrants, we don't have all that ability. So it's just kind of being creative. And so I think that there's also an appreciation now for when we would be contacted for updates on our cases, you know, by administrative folks. Now I understand why those deadlines are necessary. And, you know, like, there's just a different appreciation for how the other side handles it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I say all the time that we spend a lot of the OIG spends a lot of its time training plans and training whomever on things. And I've always thought, well, what about an SIU coming in and talking to the OIG? You know, I think when we were working as agents, we would spend so much time fielding questions from the payers about updates on cases when we may not have had an update for the last, you know, every 30 days you're getting a phone call from someone, particularly if you've got a case. You know, I remember working on cases where I had 20, 30 plans that were involved. And you're getting 20, 30 phone calls a month for an update. And it's like, why do you keep calling me for an update? And, you know, now on this side, what you learn is the plans have reporting requirements to the state. The SIUs have reporting requirements to the global plan. It's like, if you knew that, maybe we would have approached those conversations a little different. Maybe we wouldn't have ignored the phone calls as much as we did, or something along those lines. Because that's a real thing, right? I mean, everybody's busy, and so you kind of think about that. So I think that some of that gets back to, and you did this a lot when you were at the OIG. It's not just the establishment of the relationships and the partnerships that you had with people at like the MFUKU in New York, or the what they call the OMIG, Office of Medicaid Inspector General in New York, but it's constantly keeping those lines of communication open, because as that communication continues, you start to glean things and learn about what their requirements are, right? So, I mean, that becomes an important part of it. You worked with New York OMIG for a really long time, and then interestingly enough, we have a former OMIG investigator here that you worked with for years. But relationships like that, from the SIU perspective to the OI, like, so talk about that for a minute, because that transition, I mean, that was like an amazing thing, right? You had this working relationship with people in New York State, and now you're here helping run our SIU plan work, and you've got those relationships already, and so you kind of understand some of that nuance. And so in that transition, you didn't think about it at the time, but if I'm getting ready to retire and I'm thinking, what are the skills I need? It's going to be friendships, right? Because that is a skill.
But I think that goes back to communication too, right? Like there has to be an understanding of when you're working with Bafuku or Omeg, what their goal is, right, for a case. So if we're not having this open dialogue all the time, then we're not understanding what the other teammates need from this investigation or from whatever it is that we're working. So again, it goes back to communication of, how can we support them? How can they support us? And how can we work this jointly and, have everybody benefit from it?
And wait, it's interesting because we really didn't talk about this beforehand, but April brought up that really good point, right? Which is, what are the priorities? What are OMIG's priorities? What are the MFUKU's priorities? Whatever. And we talk about this all the time. We talk about instilling into your plan, into your SIU or your payment integrity team, a law enforcement liaison. And we say that, we speak the language of healthcare, we speak the language of law, we speak all this different stuff, we speak the language of law enforcement. And so understanding, like, what is that priority? And I know you know it firsthand from working cases in New York, that the priorities of the state, when you're working a state related case, a Medicaid case or something along those lines, those priorities ebb and flow. And what may be important to them now may not be important to them in a month. And so, when you're making that transition, like for you didn't even realize it, but you having those relationships with those people at OMIG, and the state wound up being a huge benefit to you in being here. Because you kind of already even if you don't know anything about what you're going to be doing, you know the people. And so that immediately sets yourself into a success, right? Because the people know you know them, you already know how to communicate with them, and that skill set just continues to grow because, right, communication is a skill set. So wait, I want to go to you for the last kind of piece as we get ready to wrap up on this kind of abridged version of the podcast. What are some of the things that you think, if I'm looking to get into the SIU space, what are the things that I should be looking to do to make myself an attractive candidate, to be part of an SIU team?
Well, one of the things to April's point is it sure helps if you know somebody that works there. I mean, that's as we were talking before about narrowing down those CVs or resumes. If there's a stack of 100 of them, but the person going through there knows somebody, or somebody on the team says, "Hey, there's a resume in there on somebody I used to work with," and they can kind of vouch for them. That's a big help. But the other thing is, again, as April said, interviewing is very important and crucial. I think just a general curiosity and wanting to, be very detail oriented and uncover every stone, those types of characters or characteristics that you can somehow determine through interviewing that they might be a good fit with that. Another thing is One thing that was very different from OI to the MCO SIU arena that I came across was that the part of the job is dealing directly with the termies and making, you know, negotiations, where with OI, we never did that. We were part of a team where the AUSAs or whatever the prosecutor was, we had input, but we didn't have any like priority or any, we weren't making the decisions on, you know, negotiations. We could give our input, and it was ultimately up to the United States Attorney's Office. But that's somewhere that I found very different, that in the SIU world, it's the actual agents and even newer or investigators that are working, that are dealing directly with the attorneys. And it works differently in different SIUs. One that I worked with, we would deal with the attorneys, and we would settle a lot of times for 50 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar. Another one that I've worked with is that's, we have to get the whole amount, but if they need to negotiate, we might take off, you know, the, if it's a 2021 through 2024 overpayment, we might say, okay, we'll drop to 2021 claims that are super old. But those are some areas that even as a new investigator, you have to deal with, whereas an experienced OI agent, I've never really had to deal with that aspect of it. So that's something to be aware of, I think.
Yeah, and that ultimately just gets to a lot of the on-the-job training and mentoring, and whether it's an official mentor or if it's an unofficial mentor, but, you know, it's surrounding yourself with the people that you know are going to give you the right answers, and not shopping for an answer that you think is right. It's, you know, going to the person who's going to give you the right answer the first time. So, you know, the other thing too to take into consideration is in a lot of job descriptions, they'll talk about some of the preferred skills. So it's important, if you're looking to get into this world, look at job postings that have been out before, not even in the government, but in the SIU space, and look and see what are some of the qualifications, what are the required qualifications, what are some of the desired qualifications. Oftentimes it's a certification, whether it be the AHFI or CFE or something like that. It's you know, it's getting one of those certifications where, you know, if you've got two people who are similarly qualified for a job and you've got that certification and someone doesn't, that's the thing that sometimes makes it a plus. I went to graduate school mostly because I thought that if I had a master's degree, I'd be more competitive than someone with a bachelor's degree. So certifications kind of fit into that same category of, you know, where could you make yourself a little bit more competitive? The landscape right now in the SIU space, in the law enforcement, federal law enforcement space particularly, is very, very competitive. So it's doing some of the things that kind of help you stand out whenever you're going to transition from one job to another. It's taking a look. The number one thing I recommend people do is look at the job posting for a similar job, even if it's not exactly what you're applying for, and even if you're not ready for the job, but it's where you want to be in a year or two. If you look and see what the job is requiring, you can kind of set yourself up for that success, you know, a year or two down the road. So, and then obviously budget is going to be a piece of that puzzle. Are the things you can do for free, or are the things that cost you money, particularly if you're a college kid? That's where internships become a big thing, because it's, while you're not going to get paid for most of them, you're at least going to get something that's going to be a resume builder. So
I think also it's important, Eric, something you brought up too, is if you look at the they used to call them KSAs, but if you look at their posting and find out what it is they're looking for, you should tailor your resume to every job that you're applying for so that it fits in those, if they're looking for certain things. I'm not saying make stuff up on your resume, but you should tailor it. So if they're looking for A, B, and C, you're not telling them that you can do D, E, and F and all these others. You should tailor it to what they're looking for. I think that's very helpful.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You can have a generic kind of resume, but you should always have your resume looked at whenever you're getting ready to apply for a particular job. You might want to use some action terms or things of that sort to have call outs so people can see who you are and what you're doing. So little different topic this week. Normally we spend a little bit more time talking about process or policy or actual fraud things, but I think sometimes it's good to just have a little bit of a off the beaten path. Welcome to the fold, April.
Thank you. I did want to add one last piece of, I have talked to so many college kids about a lie and about what we did, you know, as an agency, because not a lot of people are familiar. So I think if you can find someone in the industry that you want to be in, to talk to them about what it's really like and what it's about, and the differences between, you know, like what stands that company out from other companies or that agency.
Yeah.
It's really helpful to kind of speak to someone who's living it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I know on LinkedIn, I get messages from people on LinkedIn that say, hey, I applied for jobs as an investigator at your organization. How has your experience been? And I was like, well, considering I'm the like number two guy here, I think my experience has been pretty good. so maybe you should be asked. Maybe that's not the question to ask. But yeah, that's exactly the point, is talk to people in the industry about where it is that you want to go and kind of get advice from them about how to proceed. So yeah, good stuff. But we'll have you on again at some point, April, when we get our ducks in a row on some things, we'll include you in the fold. We'll have to make sure that you're wearing a proper advise shirt, because you can wear an OIG shirt. I got an OIG shirt on today.
I could, yeah.
Or you can wear an advise shirt, but we'll let that sleeveless number go, because you're at apparently your lake house today. So
we'll let it go. It's
90 degrees. Yeah. Well, look, everybody, thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Again, you can get our newsletter every week delivered to your inbox. You can go to our website at advise, advizehealth.com, and you'll get a box that'll pop up, let you sign up for the newsletter. You can send us a message at hello@advisehealth.com and sign up for the weekly newsletter where the OIG Roundtable will be, as well as our LinkedIn Lives from previous recorded sessions. For those of you that were on for this week's with me and Stephen Bittinger talking about statistical sampling and overpayment extrapolation, thanks for tuning into that. As always, you can get our previous OIG Roundtable podcast and our LinkedIn Live recordings on our YouTube channel, Spotify, and through our webpage. So as always, thanks for participating, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Wade.